So welcome to this new Resonate Leadership podcast series. It's called The Art of Fearless Conversation. I'm Aideen Hickey, and I'm so excited to be working today and for this series with Dr. Jeff Pelham. And I've had the pleasure to know Jeff for about 15 years, and he's the person who's most influenced me in my coaching practice. And I'm delighted to be working with him. He brings a richness of experience and also an intellectual curiosity, which I love. So welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Aideen. Yeah, I'm delighted to be here, actually. We've talked about these subjects, fearless conversations and psychological safety, you know, for a while now. And it feels like, you know, everywhere I look now, I can see this issue of say, safety and about how individuals are in the world, whether they feel safe, or at the micro level of conversations, do people feel safe to say what they really want to say? And organizations, is this a safe place to be speaking? I'm pleased to be here. It's such an important subject.
Super. Thank you, Jeff. And, you know, we've wrestled with the language of this quite a bit. And we'll get into the meat of it in a minute. But we landed on the name, The Art of Fearless Conversation. And I think there's a couple of things just to say maybe at the outset around that. And we will focus for this first conversation really on that, you know, what we mean by it. But the first thing is that there's two meanings in what we're saying to fearless when we say the fearless conversation. And one is that it's, you know, that we don't shy away from having the conversations, the honest conversations that we need to have. And that's the first part of it. But the second is the piece where we want to create environments or help people create environments where there's less fear, which can enable those conversations to take place. And we've borrowed some language here from Professor Amy Edmondson, who, you know, she's the mother of psychological safety effectively. And she wrote a book called The Fearless Organization a number of years back. And I guess in our conversations together, Jeff, we kind of realized that the norms of behavior in a team, the culture that gets built up, is shaped by the conversations that we have. So if we can bring this back to basics and talk about, well, how can we have these fearless conversations with that double meaning intended, then, you know, we can really maximize the benefits. And it has been absolutely proven that psychological safety is a foundation for, you know, team performance. So not just for the individuals, but for our team performance, organizational performance, that this is really, really important stuff for us to talk about and get our heads around.
Yeah. And in that conversation about, you know, the language to use, we started off with the notion of psychological safety, but we found there was a sense of, as if we mean it's all got to be safe and nice and comfortable, and, you know, it's quite a turn off really, and it's not the right understanding of what psychological safety means, because it actually means it's the safety to speak your mind. So this notion of fearless has kind of come alongside, or psychological safety sits within this notion of fearless, because it that kind of brings home more, those words bring home more, that there's more to this than just feeling safe. There's about taking risks, doing things that might not work as we wish, and that we feel emboldened to do this.
Exactly. And Jeff, you might take us through the territory we're going to cover over the series. So we reckon there'll probably be five or six, and we'll see how that goes.
Well, the next power, because it strikes me that power saturates all of this, and was a situation. Power is a kind of key element, really, about whether we feel safe, you know, in physical circumstances, in a relationship with individuals. Do I feel safe to say this, or is there too much at risk in terms of what could then happen in organizations? You know, we particularly see it. Do people feel safe because of the power issues in play to speak out? You know, what will happen if I'm honest here? So we want to have a look at that, and also to think of power not just as a negative. You know, to explore that sense of power is also vital in holding, like, the right culture in place or whatever. So that'll be the next podcast. And after that, we'll be looking, exploring diversity and inclusion, because again, it feels to me like power is absolutely power, and safety is absolutely at the heart of issues of culture and diversity, about whether I belong here, what can I show, who I really am, am I going to be sanctioned for this, that, or the other. So again, this feels like another key topic. And then there's a question of, well, how we measure this? Can we get a sense of what it's like here in a way that are relatively straightforward? And then can we cultivate, how do we cultivate the circumstances that enable that psychological safety that also leads to the kind of fearless conversations we'd like to have? And there's a possibility, you know, there might be a further one we're wondering about. We might have an open, almost like an open mic session, because we're guessing or hoping really that, you know, you folks listening will, you know, feel a desire to respond to some of the things you're hearing and maybe, you know, put it, points of view in, or maybe raise questions that we could have a conversation about.
And I think, you know, why did we kick this off? And it's really to start a conversation about this. When I came across psychological safety first, it was quite a long time ago. And I thought, yeah, this is a good thing. Amy Edmondson wrote this paper back in 1999. I listened to her TED Talks. It all sounded really, really good. But if I'm honest about it, it didn't actually fully resonate until a couple of years ago. And over the last few years, and I think partly during COVID and after COVID, I started to notice this more coming up as a feature in coaching conversations. And it just really seemed to resonate with me. And I guess we've got the opportunity to share what we've learned over the last while and hopefully start a conversation with other people who might be more conscious now in terms of the tone that they set in conversations in order for teams to be at a higher performance level within an organization. And I think one thing I'd just like to say there is that, you know, one thing that people maybe sometimes get turned off with psychological safety by is they think that it's either it's a binary thing or it's a judgment thing. Or if we start looking at this, what are we going to find? Are we going to find that we're not psychologically safe? But this is a continuum. And as you edge further and further and progress on that continuum, the more psychologically safe a team is, an organization is, the better the performance will actually be. So it's not binary. And so the purpose of these conversations is just to raise an awareness of the understanding of it and for people to reflect maybe on their own behaviors and the tone that they set in conversations.
Yeah. I'm curious, you said that over the time of COVID and such like, you began to notice this more in the supervision you're doing, all the work you're doing. I'm just curious about what were people saying, or I don't know if you've got any thoughts about the kind of issues that seemed to be stirring up piquing your interest in this.
So there were two types, Jeff, that came up, and the first was, and this often comes up in coaching, and I'm sure you've met it as well, where you're discussing an issue in coaching, and then you ask the client, well, so have you shared this with somebody at work, or have you discussed this issue at work? And they go, no, I know I really should, but. And so you discover that they're not actually speaking up about certain things. And, you know, you get curious about what it is that's actually the obstacle. And I find myself working with the individual to help them figure out how they can say it in a way that's safe for them, but actually flags the issue within the organization. So I guess that's one part of it. And the other part of it is I met a number of individuals through COVID, and I'm sure COVID had a part to play in it, who actually got quite anxious about going to work, that they were finding themselves in situations where they didn't feel psychologically safe to express themselves. They found themselves in situations where they were being shut down for various reasons. And I guess I was working with them to see how they could, flourish. And there were different situations that I was working, you know, in. And, you know, in one, the person moved organization, same person, different organization, different team. And they went from literally physically almost shrinking to absolutely flourishing. And that was probably a moment where I went, wow, this might not be just down to the individual. There's something systemic here. So what are the systemic factors that are going on here that are potentially impacting performance? And for one person, it might be that they're actually so anxious, they're struggling to get it going to work. But for others, there's no doubt it's affecting many other people. And so it's impeding team performance as well as affecting an individual. So those are maybe the two different types of things that came up for me, Jeff.
Yeah. I sort of recognize just what you're talking about. And it's so much part of what, what people bring to coaching and the sort of supervision issues. Often this sort of, these sort of notions come to life most through various stories, maybe not our own stories, but stories we've come across. I wonder whether you, I'm guessing that you've come across a few that really strike you as epitomizing all this.
Well, Jeff, there's one that struck me over the weekend, and it's a personal story to me from when I was in my 20s. And I'm actually fascinated by it now, looking back in hindsight at it. I worked in a multinational and I spent time working in different countries. I was an IT project manager and got dropped in to different projects. And on this particular project, the starting point, I guess, was that they didn't really want me there. I was coming from head office. I didn't speak the local language particularly well, and there was a resistance to me arriving. We got over that and I arrived, and it was a big project, about 100 people. And the first thing I needed to do was to get accepted. And so I worked really hard at that, both in terms of the local language and the relationships. And those relationships were difficult because there were four different parties on the project and they didn't have a good relationship with each other. So it was really complicated. So when we think about, people talk about VUCA world with volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, like this project had all of those elements, and it was very, very messy. And those are the times when you really need to be having clear conversation, because everybody needs to be on the same page to be able to deal with the kind of messy challenges that are faced. But this situation was really interesting because the project started to go pear-shaped. And in hindsight, the very logical thing for me to do was to pick up the phone to my boss in Dublin and say, hey, this is what the story is. But it actually did not even cross my mind to ring him. Like, we had situations even, sabotage on the project. And you'd imagine that I'd actually tell my boss that this was happening. But I didn't even make a decision, Jeff, not to call him. It simply did not occur to me to call him. And I saw there was a bit of research done. I think it was in 2003, where it was an exploratory study of silence in organizations. And 85% of people were identified that there were moments when they didn't speak up about something important. And this felt like one of those moments for me. So it's been really interesting to reflect on that in terms of psychological safety and what was going on.
So what do you think what's going on? Because I'm struck by what you said, that you didn't even consider, it never occurred to you to, if you like, report upwards. And given the significance of the size of the project and all the rest of it, it seems, for a distance, an extraordinary thing. Well, I can imagine you deliberately considering, should I report this, and weighing it all up, but not even to have it as a possibility, not occurring to you. It feels like there's a whole different level of, I don't know what you call it, really, censorship or... What do you make of it now?
So I find it really fascinating. And I think there were two things at play. The first is that my boss was much more senior to me in Dublin. And he was more senior to anybody on the project as well. And me contacting him would have been a big deal. And particularly given the remote relationship. And I think this is really relevant for, the world we're in today with a lot more virtual working. You have to work harder at relationships. And we were not in contact regularly. In fact, it was very, very irregular. It might have been twice or three times over the year. So I'd have had to make a really conscious effort. And it would have been, like setting off a flare, saying there's a major big problem. And that power differential, I think, was exaggerated due to distance, because as soon as I came back to Dublin, we sat down and I shared everything. I had no hesitation sharing everything then. But when I was remote, I didn't feel comfortable doing that. But I think there was a second factor, and that was that I was embedded within a team that I had sought acceptance from. And they were all good people, all working in the same direction, dealing with messy problems. But it wasn't that people weren't trying hard, but we were trying really hard and not making progress. So I think there was a level of loyalty that if I went and did this, I was being like a telltale or something, and not being loyal to the project team. Yeah, I think that was probably there. But the fascinating thing for me, Jeff, is how it was completely subconscious. I never even thought, I never even considered whether to speak up or not. I just simply didn't.
Yeah. So two dimensions stand out for me, that sense of the power and the authority differential. But there's also that sense of belonging and not wishing it would be almost as if you're betraying your group. And that closes down the capacity to even consider saying what needed to be said. Fascinating.
And I wasn't meek, Jeff. Like, I was at that stage in my career, I was working in different countries, different cultures, learning different languages. I was not meek, and yet it did not occur to me.
And I guess that, or maybe this is what we'll come on to, you know, later, about the whole culture, the culture of the organizations we're in, about whether it would even occur to you know, be able to report things that aren't going well. Or that you've just covered them up, sort of thing.
There's Amy Edmondson has some amazing examples of this in her book. And one of them that feels relevant to speak of here is the Tenerife air disaster, which I think was the biggest air disaster ever in history, 1977. And two Boeing 747s crashed on the runway. And they have the recordings from the flight deck. And there were three team members essentially in the cockpit that day. There was the pilot, the co-pilot, and a very, very senior flight engineer. And there was, like, the situation was very, very complicated with fog and, you know, lots of other things going on. But the pilot was very, very senior, and he actually assessed pilots. So he actually decided who could continue with our license or not. Mm-hmm. So he had a level of authority that was above the others that were in the cockpit. And he seemed to be in a rush to take off, but the other two kind of challenged him at different moments. But there came a point in time where he just said, "We're taking off," but the other two were not. It seems like from the recordings that they weren't fully comfortable, but yet they actually didn't say anymore. And in that moment, when they didn't say anymore, they went to take off, ended up crashing into the plane, and 500 plus people actually died. And these were senior people who, in that moment, appeared to self-censor. Now, I don't want to put it all down to psychological safety, because I'm sure there were lots of other factors. But when there was a study done on what went on here, they identified those human factors as being part of the issue on that particular day.
Mm. Yeah, I just imagine myself into the cockpit, and I can just get a feel for that. There's these two people who are slightly less senior, and they just kind of know this is not right, but they can't muster what it takes to, I don't know, claim authority and say, we're not taking off. That sense of deferring to the person in control who feels like they're not going to accept others' view on things. You can just feel it in my body, really, is it? And the tragedy that followed.
And of course, they've changed all the procedures in relation to it since that big air disaster now. So, you know, they're a lot more particular in terms of, you know, the power differential, leveling that power differential. And we can talk about that the next day, Jeff, but they have changed things. But it just makes it really interesting. You know, it's not just a conscious self-censoring, but sometimes it's actually a subconscious self-censoring.
So the need to be able to speak up about things that aren't going right.
Yeah.
is absolutely vital.
And that makes me think then of the research done by Google, Jeff. They ran a project called Project Aristotle, where they looked at 180 high-performing teams to understand what were the key factors to their success. Mm. And this was a multi-year, multi-million dollar project, and they couldn't figure it out initially. And this is ultimately where Amy Edmondson's work actually came to light, because somebody stumbled upon her 1999 paper and they went, wow, there's something about the norms of behavior in the teams that actually, you know, are a foundation for high performance. And it turns out that it's psychological safety, that, you know, there's lots of other things that are important in terms of, you know, purpose and, you know, et cetera. Mm. If you don't have the psychological safety as the foundation, the rest, you know, aren't sufficient in their own right. And you talked about teams performing better when they can actually report mistakes and learn, you know, learn from them. And so research has been done to actually prove that if you've got a psychologically safe environment, people are going to be more likely to learn in a team, and there's going to be better quality, more innovation within those teams as well, because people are actually freer to speak openly and more candidly within an environment, in a safe container, where they know people have their backs and it's actually safe to do that.
Yeah. It's interesting. What we've been talking about reminds, because I, you know, my background is in coaching, and I got interested with some others in coaching cultures, and through Professor Seamus Kelly at UCD, we did a study of an organisation in the UK that had really taken on coaching, really invested in it for about 10 years, and we wanted to find out what was the impact of this. Did it make a difference to the people working there, you know, to the indicators of success and so forth? And there's interesting stories from people about what it was like. This organization was a housing association that had been part of a local authority housing division, which is a total pits usually in terms of the culture and people's enjoyment of it. And so it became a housing association. And the guy who was the CEO, who kind of initiated the shift, apparently his style of leadership, there's a quote here, he said, somebody in the leadership team said, in the past, we would say, David, who's the CEO, just passed the JFDI, which was, for the uninitiated, was just fucking do it. And the belief was that if he shouted loud enough, then someone would do it. You know, we were the problem, you know, not him. Anyway, for reasons I don't quite know, he turned to coaching, and, you know, he was coached, and he got his leadership, all his leadership team people individually coached. There was team coaching. They rolled out a program of coaching skills for managers. They really invested in it and really believed in it. And I was just thinking about, in terms of psychological safety and so forth, some of the attributes that come with coaching, because I'm just curious about the overlap, if you like. And there's, I guess the core is about taking a non-judgmental attitude to people. It's about sort of trying to understand people and take care of them, you know, listening and engaging in real dialogue, asking good questions, but also about the capacity to challenge people and, you know, and to actually have those robust conversations. So it's not all about being about nice. It's about respecting people, not judging it. And how do you get people to, giving permission to people to try out things, find their own solutions, and not blaming when mistakes are made, and trying to really develop people, unlock their potential. Now, I know this is a long list, but it's a real list as well. And it really struck me that it kind of, it feels at the heart of the kinds of practices, if you like, that's probably at the heart of psychological safety. And we went and spoke to the people you know, we spoke to all levels of the organisation. We also went out when people from the organisation, remember it's a housing association, went to speak to the residents and how they did that, and even people, things like in the first contact, the complaints department, and there was a sense that these attitudes and these ways permeated the whole place, even in the complaints department. You know, people would really seek to understand what the issue was. They were not defensive, they were not judgmental. You know, we actually saw it happen. And there's a couple of quotes from people, but, you know, somebody saying, when I first started working here, I was stunned rigid by the feel of the place. Levels of trust were unbelievable. And somebody else who said that nobody ever plans to work in housing, because it's not got the greatest reputation as a place to work. But they arrive here and they end up being passionate about it. And we saw that. We saw people that they realize this is important work. And someone said, you know, I love my job, love working with my manager, love the environment, love the organization. There were no management people, and this is all anonymous. So this was real. And it was just struck me what a different sort of environment that was. And for people who think this is all very nice, but not very real, all the levels of all the indicators of success, like, you know, the profit that was being made, the residents' ratings of the service, the employee feedback, was all really positive. It was all in the plus. I know that's a long story, but it just, I suppose it stays with me because I was really touched by, you know, the genuineness of what I heard, and I guess the unusualness of it. So
I think that's a great story, Jeff, and it kind of brings it back to me about it being about conversations. So in each and every conversation that we have with other people, it's like a moment of truth in terms of our interactions that we have. As I've been having conversations about psychological safety over recent, you know, months with people, somebody told me a story. Let's call him Tom for the purposes of this conversation, how he was on a virtual call one day and there were a number of people on it. And a more senior person on the call was talking about how they needed to approach a particular project with a client. And he was concerned about it. It didn't seem to feel right to him. So he shared his view and suggested an alternative way. And now I wasn't there, so I don't know how that was said or what the over and back was. But ultimately, the person who was more senior on that call just turned to him and said, Tom, just do it. And at that moment, Tom told me that he silenced himself for the rest of the call. He came off the call and multiple people contacted him afterwards and asked, was he okay? And I guess the consequences of that one interaction, that one conversation, was actually threefold. One was Tom silencing himself on the call and potentially in future. And second of all, the other people who saw this happen are most likely, there's a ripple effect, most likely they would think twice before doing the same thing and speaking their mind, even if it's something important. And the third was that their energy ended up being diverted to talking about the behavior and not actually getting the work done. So there's something about us being mindful of the tone that we set in conversations. You described it the other day as, you know, we're passing a ball between each other as we're having a conversation and whoever has the ball, that almost shapes the next part of the conversation that's going to happen. So I think it's interesting for us to reflect on, without necessarily trying to change anything initially, but even just after this conversation, for us to notice what tone we're setting in conversations when we've got that metaphorical ball in our hands.
Your example is the opposite of my example, really. And and you just see how in that one conversation, you know, the ripple spread outwards, and what profound, it can at times maybe think as if we're just talking in an idealistic way about things, but actually that one intervention from that guy's boss just closed down so much. Just shows them such a big impact of every conversation. And I guess it invites us to take notice and be more mindful of the conversations we have. It's what are we conveying, not just in what in I don't know the information is saying, whatever, but the way we do it. Are we leaving people feeling that they've been respected, that they've been heard? I remember a time, I could still feel it after all these decades, where I was in a really bad place, and I went to speak to the CEO. So I met with him regularly, and he immediately spotted that I was not in a good place, and he just changed the conversation in a moment. And you know, I became, you know, the core, the heart of this conversation. All the business stuff didn't matter, and usually he's really on the business stuff. It's not like he's a, you know, he's trying to be nice to people all the time. And you could probably feel my voice. I could still feel it through all these decades that it was a standout moment. What did we had this notion yesterday of, we didn't call them standout moments. There was something about particular moments, particular moments in conversations that really stand out for us.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was pivotal conversations, I think we spoke of, Jeff. Yeah.
And pivotal moments in conversations. I'm guessing those who are listening have those pivotal moments. I guess the negative example is the one that you mentioned with that person being closed down. It's pivotal moments. And they really come, I guess they're embedded in a wider culture, but there's something very profound about that notion.
And I think what that example shows is that, you know, there will be times when we need to close a conversation down because we have to make progress and move on. Mm. But it's about how we do it. And
yes,
that fits into the title of the podcast series, which is The Art of Fearless Conversations. There is a bit of an art to it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to be playing with and exploring. And maybe one just model just to share, which I think is relevant to these examples, is there's a lady called Kim Scott who has developed this model of radical candor is the phrase she uses. And she talks about needing to balance candor and forthright, you know, speaking, but with care for the other person.
Mm.
And it was in the example that I shared, the care piece was actually missing. Now, we can overdo the care and not be candid enough. It's a question of balancing those two in order to have, you know, to help feed kind of a high-performing team. And it just feels like that's really important, is balancing that care with candor.
Yes. And of course, a great artist has learned their skills. Great art doesn't come just out of the air, so to speak. And there's something about the art here is rooted in particular practices that are very learnable. Going back to my coaching, you know, we can learn to listen better. We can learn to check our assumptions we're making about people. We can learn to see if we can tune in to understand their circumstance. All of these things are learnable, teachable, and as practices, they can just become, from being something you have to deliberately think about, they can just become part of the way we do things. I've seen that happen you know, for decades with people, the people I've worked with on various programs, even things like learning how to listen better. You know, it starts as a skill, becomes a way of being, which, you know, they'll think they're applying it to work, but you discover it's changing their relationships at home and with their kids and with their friends. And they don't even notice they're doing it because they've just changed, they've been changed. So I think this is the really encouraging side of all of this, or one of those encouraging sides. It's very learnable.
It is, and you remind me of an example of a client I worked with years ago, and she really wanted to develop her leadership style, and we worked on that together. And it came to performance appraisal time of year. We'd been working together probably 6 months at that stage. And one of the people in her team came in and he said, "First of all, I just want to say that my wife would like to say thank you to you." She was like, she was very puzzled and she couldn't understand why. And then he said, "Because the changes that you've made in, you know, how you're leading have affected me in such a positive way that I'm actually much happier going home in the evenings. And Jeff, you said yesterday, I think, that you had heard of the phrase that leadership is like, you know, 1,000 conversations, and it is an accumulation. It might have been a different phrase that you used, but it is the sum of all these conversations that we have. And I guess what we're encouraging the listeners to do between now and the next conversation we have about power is to just be mindful of the tone that you're setting in different conversations. And it will be different in different contexts, but just be mindful and notice it, and notice when you're having that, you have that metaphorical ball, what's the impact when you pass that on to somebody else?
We're telling a lot of stories today, but another thing that still moves me every time I hear it was in an opening round of a program we were running, and there was this guy on it. It was a real no-nonsense, you know, hard-bitten sort of CEO type. It didn't take much nonsense from anybody. And in the opening round, he said, my son took my car yesterday without asking, and he crashed it. And he said, usually I would have just laid into him. And I just said, well, tell me what happened. And
brilliant.
It said, there wasn't a dry eye in the room, because we knew what it meant. We knew what it meant. I think he talked about his relationship with his son before, and it was because he had learned and appreciated, and now was able just to be different. And I guess that's how, you know, that's the positive in all of this, that we can get there.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Jeff. So I think we're probably at a point where we need to wrap up, because we could keep telling stories, I think, all day. Yeah. But maybe we should save some for the next day. And I'm really excited to have the conversation about power, because power seems to be inextricably linked with this, in for positive and also negative. So we're going to have a little play with that the next day that we speak, Jeff.
Well, it feels like today we've been scoping the field, really. We've been mapping the field, haven't we? And my sense of the next conversation is they will be more focused, and there might not be quite so many stories, but I discovered I do enjoy sharing them.
I think what's evident from this conversation is we both feel like this is really important work, because it impacts the performance of a team and an organization. And I guess what we see in coaching is that it really impacts individuals in terms of the environment that they're working on. That's the human element of it. But it's not the only element, because it does, you know, psychological safety feeds high performance as well. So we're both really invested in this and passionate about it. So,
I'm surprised that, you know, you can hear the feelingfulness in me with these stories, you know, my own story, other people's story. It's like, whew, this is really touches deep. In its own ways.
It does. Okay. It does. Well, thank you so much for the conversation today, Jeff. And look forward to the next chat with you.
Bye then.